To call House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 27th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:15 p.m. Today we have present Representative Wright, Representative Prox, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, Representative Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. On today's agenda, we have a first bill hearing on HB 17 from Representative Carrick. We're also going to bring back up HB 99, a bill we set an amendment deadline for, received zero amendments. We have representatives from the Human Rights Commission and legal to answer questions that members might have. Starting with HB 17 from Representative Carrick, I understand that Sarah Bailey, insurance specialist from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, is available online to answer any questions. Representative Carrick, please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Ashley Carrick, state representative for House District 35 in West Fairbanks. And thank you all for taking the time to hear House Bill 17 today. I know many of the committee members have heard this legislature before, so thank you for reindulging and listening to, again. So currently there are 28 states which require health insurance plans regulated by the state to cover coverage of prescription drugs and devices to also cover prescription contraceptives. And this aligns with the federal mandate as laid out in a provision of the 2010 Affordable Care Act's health coverage guarantee requiring non-grandfathered health insurance coverage and employer-sponsored group health plans to cover preventative services, including contraceptives, without cost sharing. Furthermore, there are 22 states and the District of Columbia that have ensured that women can receive an extended supply of a contraceptive method at one time, usually a 12-month supply, rather than a typical 1 or 3 month supply. So House Bill 17 puts into Alaska statutes language consistent with the standards set in the federal contraceptive coverage guarantee. It also mandates coverage for dispensing up to 12 months of prescriptive contraceptives at one time. This allows women in rural communities and those who work extended shifts in remote locations to have a continuous supply of contraception. Research shows that women who are dispensed a 12-month supply of contraceptives have a 30% drop in unplanned pregnancy and a 46% drop in the likelihood of abortion compared to women receiving just a 1 to 3 month supply. House Bill 17 can also save money for the state. In a prior version of this legislation from a previous legislature, the Department of Health and Social Services fiscal note estimated a $1.35 million annual savings due to a reduction in unplanned pregnancies. As you can see, there are 3-0 fiscal notes attached to this bill, although it is possible that we could see savings long-term as unintended pregnancies and associated care drop. I'm bringing forward House Bill 17 because not only is it often time-consuming and inconvenient to obtain a prescription contraception every 1 or 3 months, but also because I know that improved access to contraception means improved health for women and families. Providers are still able to make decisions in consultation with their patients on what type and length of prescription to provide. What this bill does is it takes away insurance coverage as a barrier to access. Additionally, this bill could protect victims of domestic violence, especially regarding the issue of reproductive coercion or contraceptive coercion, in which abusers dictate when and how often contraceptives can or cannot be accessed as a means of gaining power and control. Supported by a long, strong body of evidence, contraceptive services have been recognized by both government and a wide range of private sector experts as a vital and effective component of preventative public health care. Contraceptive use helps women avoid unintended pregnancy and improve birth spacing, which in turn has substantial positive consequences for infants, women, families, and society. House Bill 17 makes sense for Alaskan women and families. And I hope that each of you will consider and choose to support this legislation. At this point, I want to turn it over to my staff, Sherry Bowman, to walk through the sectional. I also want to note the change from the prior from a prior committee of referral, which removed emergency contraceptive language, which is no longer in House Bill 17. I also want to note that Division of Insurance Director Lori Wing-Heyer is not able to be with us today, but has provided invited testimony in the past on some of the logistics of this bill from an insurance perspective. And we do have someone else available for questions today, I believe, on those issues. We can also bring Director Wing-Heyer forward at a later date. So with that, I'll turn it over to my staff.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. For the record, my name is Sherry Bowman, and I am staff to Representative Carrick, and I thank members of the committee for hearing House Bill 17 today. So House Bill 17 puts into Alaska statutes language that is consistent with the standards set in the Federal Contraceptive Coverage Guarantee. It also requires health insurers to, at the request of the consumer and in consultation with the healthcare provider, cover a 12-month supply of contraceptives at one time and provide reimbursement to a healthcare provider or dispensing entity. Section 1 of the bill lays this out. Section 1 also gives healthcare insurers the ability to enact reasonable cost containment measures and prevents an insurer from offsetting the costs of compliance. In subsection D, cost containment is defined as incentivizing the use of generic or lower-cost medications or the use of healthcare providers or pharmacies that offer services or prescriptions at a lower rate. The inclusion of this language gives insurers the ability to steer towards generics as a cost containment strategy, a provision that the Department of Administration had previously advocated for as it could substantially reduce their costs in covering a 12-month supply of birth control. However, subsection F states that the covered therapeutically equivalent version of a prescription contraceptive is not available or is considered medically inadvisable by the healthcare provider or the insured, a healthcare insurer shall provide coverage without cost sharing for an alternative therapeutically equivalent version of the prescription contraceptive that is prescribed for the insured. The inclusion of this language establishes that even though insurers will be allowed to steer towards generics, if a particular generic or brand is determined medically inappropriate by the healthcare provider, then the insurer must accommodate the insured. Finally, subsection AH includes a religious exemption, so health plans sponsored by certain exempt religious employers are not subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 2 amends AS 2910-200 by adding a provision applying to home rule municipalities. Section 3 amends AS 2920 by adding a new section, clarifying that municipal health care insurance plans that are self-insured are subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 4 amends AS 393090 subsection A, which relates to policies of a group insurance covering state employees, by adding a new subsection 13 to capture group health insurance policies covering employees of a participating governmental unit. Section 5 amends AS 393091, which relates to self-insurance and excess loss insurance, by adding language to capture a self-insured group medical plan covering active state employees. Sections 4 and 5 clarify that the requirements of Section 1 apply to active state employees. Section 6 directs the Department of Health to cover the 12-month supply of prescription contraceptives for eligible recipients of medical assistance. Section 7 directs the Department of Health to amend and submit for federal approval a state plan for medical assistance coverage consistent with Section 6. Section 8 is a conditional effect of Section 6 of this bill, and Section 9 pertains to effective dates. And Representative Carrick did go over the summary of changes, which, just to reiterate, removes emergency contraceptive language from the bill. And we do have Sarah Bailey from the Division of Insurance available for questions. So thank you.
Thank you. And let the record reflect that Representative Sadler joined us at 3:18 p.m. Representative Carrick, did you – I see a Charles Semling on the phone. Was that just for questions or invited testimony?
Thank you. Through the chair, that is just for questions as well. Charles is available.
Thank you. Questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Prox?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair – I just picked up on Section 1. It prevents an insurer from offsetting the cost of compliance. And I just want to clarify our intent. This wouldn't prevent an insurer from including the cost of compliance in their general insurance rates. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, that is my understanding. That would be a very good question for Director Winghire as well. Were she here? We might want to ask our potential questions, Sarah Bailey, that question as well.
Mrs. Bailey, if you're on the line and you heard that question, perhaps you could opine on it. Thank you.
For the record, this is Sarah Bailey. Through the chair, my understanding of the bill is that the insurers cannot adjust cost shares, such as deductibles and copayments. And so we would expect them to be able to apply it to their premiums. However, we do also expect there to be some cost savings. And it's also worth mentioning that under current federal law, insurers cannot apply deductibles or cost sharing on contraceptives currently. And I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, I think I'm sorry, through the chair, I think that it does. I just wanted to clarify the point on record if that ever comes up. Follow up?
Go ahead.
In Section 5, authorization for self-insurance and excess loss insurance, I can't imagine, again, clearing it up for the record, I can't imagine that this bill would affect excess loss insurance coverage. Because that's usually, you have to spend $1 million or something like that, the plan does. But is there, same question, is there any way that this could actually affect an excess loss insurance policy?
Mrs. Bailey, yes. If you had heard that question, I think perhaps that was directed to you as well. Thank you.
Yes, through the chair, Sarah Bailey, for the record. I would agree that it would be highly unlikely that it would impact an excess loss plan.
Yeah, I think that probably is good enough. To be clear, that this addresses either, or it affects either the, if there's a group insurance provider that provides first coverage, or a self-insured plan that provides first coverage. That's what we're talking about here.
Through the chair to Representative Prox, it seems unlikely excess loss would actually be a factor with this legislation. I think many of the provisions placed in legislation sometimes are just legislative legal, trying to cover all the bases that right. could apply. So I think that that's probably the case with Section 5.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Kurek, your sponsor statement says that it cites some of the reasons for this legislation. That, for example, women in Alaska may work in the North Slope or in fishing boats, limiting access to reproductive health care and prescriptive contraceptives. Do Alaska women working in the North Slope tend to work longer than 2 weeks at a time, or even as long as a month at a time on a North Slope turn?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, I do believe that most people who work on the North Slope work 2 weeks at a time. One of the major challenges that Alaskan women are currently facing that this legislation seeks to address is you can't go to pick up your next prescription dose until you're within a few days of needing that next prescription dose. And the logistical challenge that can present for Alaskan women to ensure that they have seen their pharmacist and potentially their provider as well within a certain number of days before traveling for work, whether that's 2 weeks on the North Slope or 2 months on a fishing boat, helps prevent that logistical challenge. And additionally, I would just note that another aspect of this is ensuring contraceptive access is as smooth as possible on the level of insurance coverage for women who live in rural Alaska. And so for those who don't have access to a hub community or a pharmacist on a regular basis, that is a major reason this is being brought forward.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Kerry through the chair. Educate me, if you will, about the accessibility of prescription drugs or contraceptive drugs in rural Alaska. Do women living in rural Alaska have to travel outside of their villages to receive any prescription drugs or all prescription drugs?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, in order to begin using a birth control or other prescription drugs, women have to have access to a provider and they have to have access to a pharmacist. And while women can receive prescription drugs through the mail, we know that mail in rural Alaska is quite unreliable. And again, this is intended to help increase the availability for women who may only come into a hub community where a provider and a pharmacist are available every so often, unlike folks like me living in Fairbanks or folks living in Anchorage where we have more consistent availability.
If you would, please. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Kerrick. So help me understand, if you would, why the challenges you're citing justify a full year's worth of contraception as opposed to a couple extra weeks or a couple extra months.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I believe that a year is a perfectly reasonable amount of time for someone to be able to access contraception. The pharmacist we have available for questions can help attest to the fact that birth control methods, especially in consultation with a provider, are safe. They help mitigate and control many conditions, not just preventing pregnancy. And Alaskan women have asked for this consistently for a long time. And I do believe that a year's supply really takes out that uncertainty. It takes out those logistical burdens, and it makes access far easier, and it's safe for Alaskan women to have those 12-month prescriptions. And again, there are a number of states who have already worked on this issue.
Last question, if I may. Would the conditions you're describing as justification for this be addressed if they extended the period to 3 months or even outside 6 months as opposed to a year?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think they would be better addressed in the current situation. However, unless there was a very strong medical reason why a woman should not be able to get a year's supply of contraception, I would really struggle to see the utility of adding that limitation. And that is the limitation is what we're currently seeking to address.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair, through the chair. Representative, could you, I read here, travel limitations can create barriers regarding consistent access to reproductive health care. Could you give us an example? I'm imagining something like, you know, being in a hub situation and having to come out from rural areas. Is that what you're talking about?
Through the chair to Representative Wright, that's precisely the scenario we're mostly seeking to address here. I will note, too, we have had aside from women in rural Alaska, we've had women in urban parts of the state. I know a number of constituents in my district in West Fairbanks who they help control medical conditions like endometriosis and other challenges with a birth control prescription. And just the uncertainty of having to go in every time and making time for that out of a busy schedule. I know we've had one testifier in particular who will probably speak to public testimony at a later date, who has talked about just the challenge that it faces if you're a working parent with a shift that doesn't allow you flexibility to leave at any given time. And these prescriptions are, again, not just about preventing pregnancy. They're also very valuable for women for working through other medical conditions they might have. And so the barrier is essentially the the inconvenience, the stress that that places on a person, and the potential challenge of just getting to a pharmacist and making sure you get that prescription as often as you need to currently.
Other questions? No? Okay, seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside for a future date. Be setting an amendment deadline for this bill for Friday, and we will also schedule a future date for public testimony. Thank you. Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. Moving on to House Bill 99 from Representative Armstrong. As I said earlier, we received no amendments on this bill before the deadline, but we do want to give members an opportunity to ask the Human Rights Commission questions as well as Ledge Legal. Representative Armstrong, you also can approach the committee and put your name on the record if there are any further questions for the bill sponsor.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. For the record, Jenny Armstrong, representative from House District 16.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong.
Okay. Does anybody on the committee have questions for Robert Corbusier from the from the Human Rights Commission, or Margaret Bergerud? Probably all, yeah, from Ledge Legal. And actually, both of you, can you please state your names for the record and pronounce them for me? Thank you.
For the record, this is Margaret Bergerud with Ledge Legal.
This is Rob Corbusier with the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights.
So do any members have questions for Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you for, I guess, whomever. The fiscal note indicates that this is giving the Human Rights Commission the authority to hear cases, hear new cases, cases that they hadn't heard before. Is that correct?
Through the chair, this is Rob Corbusier. Yes and no. So when Bostock v. Clayton County was first issued by the U.S. Supreme Court, we almost immediately started taking employment cases pending a question from the Department of Law as to what the full application of Bostock v. Clayton County was. In December of 2020, we received that guidance from the Department of Law that we could take cases, LGBTQ cases, in all five of our subject matter areas. And so we did. And we were taking those cases until the Attorney General updated that advice in August of last year. So we are still taking – we never stopped taking employment-related LGBTQ cases. We stopped taking – LGBTQ cases in the other four areas. So places of public accommodation, sale and rental of real property, credit and financing, and government practices. So the proposed bill, HB 99, essentially aligns state law with what the U.S. Supreme Court said that the definition of sex is in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And it allows us explicitly to take LGBTQ cases kind of across the board, not as an independent protected class, but because it falls within the definition of sex.
Okay. And I'm not quite understanding the sequence of events or what prompted apparently the Attorney General to first agree that the Human Rights Commission had authority to take these cases, and then subsequently wrote an opinion indicating that the Human Rights Commission does not have the authority to take those cases. So could somebody please explain what prompted the Attorney General's office to change their mind?
Through the chair, I this is Rob Corbusier. I don't know the origin of the Attorney General's desire to change that was. I had a brief phone call from Attorney General Taylor. It was toward the beginning of last year, and then I received an email from him in August that said, and our phone call was fairly brief, and he didn't fully understand totally what ASHRAE did, what our statutory authority was, what our mission was outside of just employment. So we had a brief conversation just explaining to him fully what we did, and I explained to him what the kind of the application of Bostock was and what the prior advice was from the Department of Law. And then I, in August, received an email. I had no other follow-up conversation before or after that email in August of last year.
Perhaps Mrs. Bergerud, sorry if I still mispronounced that, you could address that question. Thank you.
Through the chair, this is Margaret Bergerud of Ledge Legal. I can't speak anymore to that point. It's my understanding that, I guess, part of an email communication between the Attorney General and the Human Rights Commission was released to a journalist over the weekend, redacted, that may be able to give us a little more insight into the decision that the administration made, but I was not privy, nor was Ledge Legal, to any of that internal decision-making from the executive branch.
Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Bergerud, is there a written redaction from the Department of Law, or was that just based on a phone call?
Phone call.
My understanding, through the chair, my understanding is that there was an email between the AG's office and the commission, but that it was not necessarily an official AG opinion. And that a redacted version was released over the weekend to the press.
Follow up, is that of correspondence available?
Can we take a brief at ease? Representative Armstrong can potentially address this question.
Okay.
Thank you, through the chair. Our understanding was that Bostock was limited to employment, and some states, when Bostock said that discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity expression is inherently based on sex, other places decided that anywhere sex appeared, that meant that that encompassed that. And as you know, sex is in the Human Rights Commission language. But our understanding was that instead of just applying that definition, they wanted to keep it narrow to employment, and that if we wanted to cover the other four subject areas, we had to be explicit in putting that in statute. So different people have interpreted and applied Bostock in different ways.
Okay. Follow up.
Go ahead.
Is there another title of federal law, something other than Title VII, that the Human Rights Commission relies on to accept cases?
I think this one's probably for me, through the chair. I mean, yes and no. We definitely look at ADA guidance for how we look at disability claims. Obviously, a lot of ADA stuff ends up coming through employment as well. We also, to a certain extent, will look at HUD for guidance in housing-related stuff. Title VII is a little more explicit because the Alaska Supreme Court has repeatedly affirmed that we are to interpret AS 1880 using the framework of Title VII. We also have a contract with the EEOC that allows us, requires us to investigate Title VII cases in Alaska that are otherwise co-jurisdictional with the EEOC. And we do receive federal funding based on that contract for each case that we investigate and resolve.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Do I understand correctly then that the expenses associated with handling these complaints that are not under the jurisdiction of the Equal Employment Opportunity Office of Equal Employment Opportunity would not be reimbursed by the federal government?
Through the chair, that is correct. But the committee should also understand that like 80% of our cases are employment-related cases. So by far and away, the bulk of our processing is all employment-related cases.
Okay, follow up. So for examples, blockbusting or common places that are open to the general public. I forgot the technical name. Common access. That would, this statute or this bill would give the authority to the Equal Employment Offices Commission, no, Human Rights Commission, to pursue those complaints, but then the expectation would be that the Human Rights Commission would not be reimbursed by the federal government for pursuing those complaints.
Through the chair, that is correct. We're not reimbursed by the federal government for any of our public accommodation cases now.
Public accommodation, right. Okay, follow up. In the view of the Human Rights Commission, would this then also apply to, I believe it's Title IX, education and athletics?
Through the chair, Title IX is outside of what the Human Rights Commission deals with.
Okay.
We did, I had Representative Armstrong, I asked Representative Armstrong to clarify after the last hearing. We do have jurisdiction over certain schools to the extent that a school is a subsidiary of the state and local government. So we do have jurisdiction over schools. We also have a regulation that defines public accommodation to include educational institutions. But I don't know that we actually have really looked at Title IX. Maybe we would look at Title IX now that I think about it. I don't know that we have looked at Title IX in applying AS 1880 to any cases though. I'd have to get back to the commission. I'd have to get back to the committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If anyone else wants to, I'm happy to wait.
Margaret Bergerig, led to legal, about how this really wouldn't intersect with Title IX. So Title IX is, you know, is a federal program that mandates sex equity in educational institutions that receive federal funding, and their definition of sex is in federal regulation. The Human Rights Commission in Alaska, to the extent that the school is within the definition of an employer, would have Title VII, and now Human Rights Commission jurisdiction over employment-related complaints made, or discrimination complaints made in school related only to employment. Students who are not employees would not have any expanded rights under this bill. It would not affect the definition of sex under Title IX for schools.
Follow up?
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Okay, I think I understand that. But if just a member of the general public came into a school building, the human, and somehow was discriminated against, the Human Rights Commission would have jurisdiction for an event like that. It's not necessarily related to education or sports, but it is related to public access. Is that a fair statement?
Through the chair, I would say yes. We could potentially take that case as both a government practices case as well as a public accommodation case. I mean, it would depend on the, you know, facts of the individual case, but potentially yes.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. This question through the chair is for Mr. Corbusier. Is it, I'm seeing it in the fiscal note, but just want to confirm if it's an accurate statement that the State Commission on Human Rights can handle the new mandates in this bill with existing staff and financial resources.
Through the chair, that is 100% accurate. I mean, we were doing all of those cases from approximately December of 2020 until August of last year. And it didn't require any additional funding.
And just a follow-up through the chair, Mr. Corbusier, do you have an estimate of approximately how many cases that was during that time frame?
Through the chair, I do not. And this has come up before, but we were not independently tracking LGBTQ because it, even under Bostock, was not an independently protected class. Mm-hmm. Because Bostock said it is underneath the definition of sex. So we were taking those cases, but we were taking them and tracking them just based on the sex-based discrimination.
Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, I have a question for Mr. Corbusier and then one for Margaret Bergerud. So first one for Mr. Corbusier. So given what you had just said about the definition of Bostock and putting discrimination cases under just the general heading of sex if it involved LGBTQ issues, this bill would essentially ensure that that process or that way of looking at this would continue. Is that an accurate assessment?
Through the chair, that is an accurate assessment.
Okay, thank you. Because
you are the co-chair.
And then a second question just for the legal aspect of things. I'm trying to determine how the definitions put inside AS 1880 links our statute with Title VII. Somehow I'm not figuring out how that's linked, nor how that's related to blockbusting, or maybe just blockbusting was an addition to HB 99 just as a piece of cleanup. Is that something that you could speak to?
Calling is unmuted. Through the chair, Margaret Bergerud, Ledge Legal. So related to Section 1 and blockbusting, this bill actually adds sex discrimination and blockbusting to the list of prohibited discrimination in Alaska. Current law does not prohibit blockbusting based on sex, so we added that in there so that you can't blockbust in Alaska based on any protected classes. Section 2 does not explicitly reference Title VII. That's something that we disfavor when we're drafting. Rather, what this does is it adopts the definition of sex discrimination that is laid out by Justice Gorsuch in the Bostock opinion into the definition of sex under Alaska statute. So Bostock, of course, it's right. Sex discrimination necessarily includes discrimination based on gender ID and sexual orientation. So this bill says that sex in Alaska for purposes of discrimination includes sexual orientation and gender identity. sexual orientation and gender identity are not defined explicitly in federal statute, but there are federal regulations supporting Title VII that have substantially similar definitions of gender identity and sexual orientation. They've been tweaked a little bit to comport with the way we draft in Alaska, but that's how this statute interacts with Title VII, is it would codify, or this bill, it would codify in statute the federal regulatory definitions that were adopted post-Bostock.
Just a follow-up to that, if I may. Just to make sure that I understand. It's weird to hear yourself back like that. Just to make sure I understand, so there is not necessarily a link to Title VII, but this bill, its intention is to take the language from the judge's decision, codify it, and by codifying it, essentially, allowing it to more closely match what is currently in federal regulation, not Title VII.
Your line is unmuted.
I think you got it, and I would just add one of the reasons Title VII keeps coming up is that when the Alaska human rights law was very first enacted, it was explicitly written to follow the format based on Title VII. So that's where that connection is in the background of all of this.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Prox.
Yes, through the chair. Section 1, the amendment to Section 1, deleting any such and adding the word that, seems to narrow the application of that particular section. And I think the commission agreed with that. Perhaps, I guess this would be to the sponsor. What was the reason for narrowing that definition?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Through the chair, Representative Prox, this, to my understanding, is a conforming change that was also present in the prior version of this bill in the prior session before this body. And so that's where the change made on page 1, line 8, was a conforming change from the prior session. And per my understanding with legislative legal, that is just something that is no longer used by our drafting standards. I'll let Ms. Bergerud speak to that if she needs to.
Your line is unmuted.
For the record, Margaret Bergerud, Ledge Legal. Yes, we view this as a conforming change, not a substantive one. But if the committee wanted us to change it back, certainly we would.
Go ahead.
So I guess that makes sense. One just always has to be careful about every word when you're dealing with legal. But on Section 2, then, it adds some definitions, broadening considerably the definition of sex. And this particular section, then, 1883-300, applies to everything about Alaska Statute 1880. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Margaret Bergerud, Lunch Legal, yes, that's correct.
Okay. And do we have some cases, I guess preferably in Alaska, do we have some cases current that have currently been decided that could help us understand how that might be applied? The definitions in Section 2.
Through the chair, I guess I need a little bit of clarification about that. Are you asking if the Alaska courts have decided on this issue yet?
Correct.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Perhaps even prior
so, no,
to
no, you do not have any local or any state guidance as far as I am aware, even at the district court level yet. I think one of the reasons for that is that the federal courts have been who's addressing this because BOSDOC came out in 2020. So people have been able to just go the federal route instead of taking a state court route.
Okay. Aloy?
Go ahead.
Are there cases in addition to BOSDOC that might help us understand how this might apply in other instances? In other words, BOSDOC...
consolidation of several cases. So there were more than one. There was more than one factual scenario before the court there. I'm not aware of whether or not in public accommodations there's anything going up to the Supreme Court right now. The committee may be familiar with the Colorado cake shop case. That was something that was remanded on, you know, technical procedural grounds back to the state. So we don't have substantive guidance there. There is a national injunction going through the federal courts right now that is related to this expanded definition of sex only in the Title IX context. That case alleges that the federal rulemaking process was subverted in adopting new definitions of sex under Title IX, and so the federal government has been enjoined from enforcing a new Title IX definition of sex. So I guess kind of to summarize, there are many cases winding their way through the courts right now, but we don't have the guidance back yet.
Perhaps Representative Armstrong or her staff?
For the record, this is Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Representative Prox, to your question, we adopted on page 2, line 4 through 7. These are identical terms to the language adopted in the prior version of this bill in the prior session. And then on item 20, lines 8 and 9, we actually added the term sex to the bill. And then on line 10 through 12, item 21, we, Representative Armstrong, felt the need to update the definition of sexual orientation because in much of the previous case law, it relied on outdated terminology that simply defined sexual orientation as homosexual, bisexual, or heterosexual. And so even with the current Merriam-Webster's dictionary definition, that is an outdated classification that might end up in future litigation for the state. And so we'd be happy to provide more context if you need any.
Thank you. I probably do. thank you. Through the chair, as a follow-up, is Merriam-Webster's, the definition in Merriam-Webster's, is that recognized by the courts as kind of the authority as opposed to Black's dictionary?
Through the chair, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Traditionally, I think that we have relied on a combination of Merriam-Webster and Black's Law Dictionary, but I will also defer to Ms. Burt-Rood.
Through the chair, Margaret Burt-Rood, Ledge Legal. Well, the first thing that I'll ask the courts are going to do in the statutory interpretation question is look to the plain meaning of a of the language, which is basically what do a group of people such as ourselves think a word means when we're sitting around and discussing it. After that, they're going to look to some dictionaries, and Black's and Webster's certainly are both sources. I'd also say Oxford's is So there's not a definitive way to define a word, but the first thing we're going to do in Alaska, at least, is look at what everyone kind of thinks it means right off the bat, and then look at a couple different dictionary definitions and find what the common thread is between all of those.
Okay. Follow up?
Go ahead, Representative Crox.
I guess that gets to my core concern. The plain language well, it changes over time. And I don't know that there is a common understanding of what this means. Certainly I don't understand. From what I read, and I led it, just different life. This has not come up in my personal experience. But I can imagine a situation, for instance, where someone obtains a job, is hired, and then some point in the future might be a day, it might be months, it might be a year, I don't know. But they show up in, what do they call that, drag, which is another thing I don't completely understand. But the picture that comes to mind when we talk about dressed in drag is fairly garish attire, whether it's male or female. And that garish attire itself might not be appropriate for the workplace setting, or the employer might judge that it's not. But then I would guess could not do anything about it under this definition.
Could I ask a question to clarify that to, I guess, Rob Corbusier, please?
Representative Fields.
Mr. Corbusier, Representative Crox brings up something that I guess we haven't talked about unless I missed it. Let's say we expand the definition here. I'm assuming that an employer, notwithstanding someone's sexual orientation, would nonetheless be able to maintain expectations around what is proper attire at the workplace, i.e. an employer could say, drag is not appropriate, whatever your sexual orientation is. Do you think that's reasonable to anticipate? Thank you.
Through the chair, yes, that's 100% reasonable. I mean, an employer can set a reasonable expectation for a dress code. I mean, even now, you can have a dress code that says something like, no hoodies allowed, no jeans allowed. Those are gender-neutral pieces of clothing that are perfectly allowable under law. So, I mean, even if you're going to have, a uniform requirement, and, you were going to do something like, a more gendered version, two versions of the uniform or something like that. So long as the employee wore one of those uniforms, that would fall within the rubric of what would be allowed. Now, the employee decides they don't want to wear that uniform, or they're going to show up dressed in drag, and you've got a professional business attire requirement for your workplace, well, dressing in drag isn't going to be appropriate. Just having anybody show up dressed garishly in a circumstance where you've got a professional business attire requirement for your dress code, that's not going to be allowed. So, I mean, in the event that that case was presented to the commission, sure, that would be an articulable basis for a protected class and gender-based, sex-based discrimination. We would take the case in, but that's the kind of thing where I would expect the respondent employer to immediately say, whoa, wait a second. We've got a dress code here. This had nothing to do with the fact that the person, what their gender identity is or what their personal activities on the weekend are. This was based on the fact that they violated our dress code. Also keep in mind, we're taking employment-related cases now based on what the Department of Law has told us, based on what the Attorney General has told us.
Representative Armstrong, our staff.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff, Representative Armstrong. Through the chair, Representative Crox, I think I'll note for the record that drag is typically described as an art form and is generally not something that would be a workplace consideration. However, to your question, if an employee were to come out as transgender or change their gender identity, and an employer were to let that employee go, that is a verbatim case from Bostock v. Clayton County with Amy Stephens and RG and GR Harris Funeral Homes. So that is directly addressed in the Bostock case.
Keep going. Sorry.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Corbasier, the question strikes me, is there a finite universe of gender identities?
Through the chair, I would say no, based on my training and experience.
Would it be fair to, through the chair, Mr. Corbasier, is it therefore a subjective, the assertion sufficient to prove its existence? If there is no limited universe?
Through the chair, you still end up with an objective test vis-a-vis what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Bostock v. Clayton County.
I think I heard somewhat contradictory answers. Help me understand. I did hear you say there is no finite universe, but then you said there is, depending on the Supreme Court's decision. Could you help me understand?
Through the chair, I mean, I don't see that there's a finite universe. You still have an objective test. And the way that the Supreme Court, I mean, here's the example that I give that came out of the case. You know, let's say you've got a female employee, and that female employee is married to a man, and the employer has no qualms with that. You take that same female employee and have that female employee married to a woman, and the employer says, that's a problem, you're fired. That is a sex-based discrimination. You can also flip that on its head. I mean, you take a male employee married to a female, and the employer says, that's fine with that, and then take the exact same employee but change the gender to female, still married to a female. Mm-hmm. That's a sex, and the employer says, that's a problem. That's a sex-based discrimination.
Right. To the chair, Mr. Kobasi, I do understand the Bostock test, but I'm just trying to understand how that you're giving me a for example, but not the universal answer. If there is no finite universe, then anybody can assert that their gender identity exists and that they are being treated differently because of that. Is that a fair statement or not?
Through the chair, that's a fair statement. I mean, in the same vein, though, there is no finite universal race. But every member of humanity, every human being, has race as a protected class right now.
Could you repeat that, sir? I'm sorry.
I said there is no finite universe of race for humans. You know, there's a lot of different kinds of races. And race is a protected class. Every single human being is a member of a protected class. That is their race.
So we're all special. Okay, great. Thank you for your time, sir.
Representative Fields.
I think through the chair to Representative Sadler, what Mr. Corbisier wasn't adding is that when you have discrimination cases, it's not just what gender are you, what race are you, but you have to prove that you were discriminated against because of that. And that's the key. That's the key point. So everyone would still have to prove that they're discriminate against, and there's actually a pretty high bar in terms of the evidence, I think, when you look at the record. Thank you.
And Mr. Walsh, did you have a comment?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think to what Mr. Corbusier was saying in terms of answering your question, in the Bostock opinion, Justice Gorsuch creates a series of tests to examine the cases the employers make, and I'll paraphrase, but one of the tests he imagines is an applicant for a job submits a application and the employer redacts all information from the application with the exception of gender identity, gender expression, or sexual orientation. And so those are the only traits that an employer can see. And so then if the employer were to instruct the applicant to respond to that box on a job application, attempting to do so without using the definition of sex is, in his words, cannot be done. And so that's where it reflects in the Supreme Court's decision on employment.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Prox.
This could go on a while. Let me cite two examples. I don't mean to be a pest, because I can imagine that inappropriate discrimination does occur. I can imagine that. Goodness sakes, 30 years ago, it was fairly uncommon for males to have a ring in their ear. And sure enough, one day a friend of mine showed up with the earring. And that caused some discussion. And whether it was in the right ear or the left ear meant something, was it I don't know if it is, but it was interpreted as a sign that you might be interested in what they now call gay men. And he claimed it was not. That was just something he thought was kind of interesting. Pirates, I guess, 100 years ago had earrings. So somebody could draw the wrong conclusion. And then several years ago, I was in the position to hire people for a retail store. And a gentleman came in with a tongue stud, which was kind of a novel thing. And I really didn't know what that meant, but it was uncommon for anybody to wear a tongue stud. I had no idea what that meant. And I still don't have any idea what that means, if it means anything. But he seemed like he would be a fairly good salesperson, so I hired him, but said the tongue stud is not allowed. We didn't have any written policy. It had never come up before. A couple days later, tongue stud in. There we go. And I explained to him that, you know, we talked about this. It just doesn't seem appropriate for our store. Okay. And a couple days later, it's in again. I canned him, not because of the tongue stud, but because he couldn't follow instructions. And he was good salesperson. Would I have been exposed now under this law to some sort of a discrimination suit?
So I think I could maybe answer that reading Bostock here. The answer to the question is, if you would have had the same response if it had been a female employee with the tongue stud in, then the answer would be you did not discriminate.
Right.
But if it was only for male employees, then under Bostock, that would be discrimination.
Right. Well, and this is where I really am honestly concerned. What do you do? Because in that specific situation, that was the first person that came into the store wanting a job wearing a tongue stud. So I can see these things happening through the
Representative Carrick.
So I'm wondering through the chair, if Mr. Corbisi, if there's a chance you could maybe go over a sample case, or at least a theoretical example, just illustrating the burden of proof that's required for a case to actually be pursued. I mean, this goes to Representative Fields' question earlier and some of the comments we've heard. It's actually quite a high bar for State Commission on Human Rights to take up a case. And having read we just had the State Commission on Human Rights' annual report in our inboxes today, and I looked through some of those cases. And in every example where the commission was involved, the bar for evidence was pretty high. So I'm wondering if there's maybe an example you could provide from the time period when Asher was able to take on these complaints.
So through the chair, I can't. So anything that is not in our annual report, even things that are in the details of cases are, that are in our annual report, aren't things that we can talk about due to our exemption from the public records law. I mean, I can tell you generally about the process and what the evidentiary standards are. I mean, from the outset, we are essentially required to take any case that walks in the door that where the complainant articulates a jurisdictional basis. So, you know, even if we end up ultimately quickly finding that this isn't a case at all, if someone comes in and says, well, for example, the very first case we did under our resolutions conference system, the complainant stated that it was a disability-based discrimination employment case. And so we brought the parties in, and internally we call it Bring Your Stuff Day. We want the respondent and the complainant to bring as much or all of their documentation as they possibly can to try and front-load our case and help us get the case closed sooner. And we got the medical documentation from the complainant, and it was immediately clear to us that this was not a qualifying disability. And so that's a case where, you know, under other circumstances, we would have just immediately been able to issue a no substantial evidence determination, and that we would have had the record that could be defended on an appeal. To get us to substantial evidence, it actually doesn't take a whole lot. The Supreme Court has said that substantial evidence is somewhere between reasonable suspicion and probable cause. Probable cause is kind of that 50% threshold. So we can get a case where it ends up being a he said, she said type case. And that is enough to get us to substantial evidence. That doesn't mean it's a case that we necessarily want to take to trial. So we'll take a substantial evidence case and try and conciliate it. So we'll try and enter negotiations with the respondents. But if conciliation fails and we have to then make the decision as to whether we're going to take the case to trial, we still have to prove the case by preponderance of the evidence. So that is the more than 50% threshold. And I, having been a former DA, like to look at all cases and all of my evidence, proving a case beyond a reasonable doubt. But we look at those cases again, and then we're like, all right, you know, just because we found substantial evidence, is this a case we actually want to take to trial, or is this one that really doesn't make any sense, and we're probably going to lose, or this is just going to end up being a waste of everybody's time and a waste of state resources. And we make that call then as to whether we want to pursue the case because we think we can prove it by a preponderance of the evidence. And usually those are the good cases. And those are the cases that respondents know they're probably going to lose. And those tend to be cases that they want to settle out. And there was another case we did. It was really, really recently. And we settled it early on. We settled it in this new resolutions conference process. It was an egregious fact pattern. It was an employment case. The victim, I got to give up that it's a sex-based discrimination. The victim's employer had physically assaulted her, and there was an assault for charge associated with the case. That's a real strong case. I mean, we had an egregious set of facts in this. You know, highlighted by the fact that there was an actual criminal charge associated with it too. But that's also a case that settled real fast. And I mean, the complainant got a $15,000 compensatory damages award as a result of this settlement. I hope that kind of answered the question.
Thank you. Yes, it does.
Mr. Walsh, you have a comment?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Representative Prox, to your question regarding your employee, you would have, as an employer, the right to expect a dress code in your place of business. And the area where any business would be potentially in violation of Bostock and hence the Civil Rights Act is where you relate that trait to their sex and the termination or the job action to sex. And so with permission from the chair, I could quote very briefly from Justice Gorsuch's Bostock decision. This is on page 5 of the opinion of the court. Essentially, Bostock itself revolved around the definition of sex and the definition of sex adopted when the Civil Rights Act was passed. Most notably, the statute prohibits employers from taking certain actions because of sex. And as this court has previously explained, the ordinary meaning because of is by reason of or on account of. In the language of this law, this means that Title VII's because of test incorporates the simple and traditional standard of but-for causation. In other words, a but-for test directs us to change one thing at a time and see if the outcome changes. If it does, we have found a but-for cause. And so in the three cases consolidated in Bostock, the employers made their decisions in part based on the employee's sex, and under that definition, their gender identity or in sexual orientation. So the result was, in Justice Gorsuch's words, momentous, that even though they did not know in 1964 that they could be adopting such an interpretation, they made sure that the statute was broad and could be applied in many scenarios.
Thank you. We're going to take a 5-minute at ease. Back on the record. Other questions? No? Representative Ruppridge? Oh, Representative Wright.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Through the Chair. And this may be for Mr. Corbusier. Are there any mechanisms in place for fraud if someone were to say, just following up the question, it was asked earlier from the representative here, Mr. Representative Prox, is there any mechanisms that would stop fraud from happening in the case of someone taking this and, you know, not actually, you know, choosing my words very carefully, sorry. someone who isn't LGBTQ saying that they are, and this is why you kicked me out of my home.
Representative Wright, through the chair. The answer is yeah. That's why we have an investigation. That's why we have a team of investigators that are professional staff that do this day in and day out. We have to look at every single case neutrally. And, you know, that means we question both sides. We don't, you know, just because a complaint comes in the door and the complainant articulates a jurisdictional case doesn't mean we take it at face value. And, you know, that's where we get into what are our actual case processing statistics. Like 90% of our cases end up being no substantial evidence findings. You know, and even where we do issue either a substantial evidence finding or a no substantial evidence finding, there is an opportunity to appeal those cases into the Superior Court. So, I mean, you know, even if we take a case all the way to trial in the administrative hearing level and the commission itself issues its order adopting the ALJ finding and that the respondent did something discriminatory, the respondent still has the ability to appeal that into the Superior Court, and they can look at all of our record. In the same way, I mean, if we issue a no substantial evidence finding, the complainant can appeal that into the Superior Court and also review our record that way, too.
Follow up.
Go ahead, Representative Wright.
To the chair, are there any consequences that you could speak of? If someone got through the entire process and then you realized that wasn't the case?
Through the chair, there is an ability, I think it's written into our regulation, where there could be an award of attorney's fees issued when circumstances merit it.
Thank you.
Representative Armstrong, closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Thank you, members of the committee. When I was running for office, I knocked on a door and a teenager answered. Their parents were not home, which is who I was there to speak to. And even though this teen could not vote for me, I wanted to hear what they thought. And I just asked for, you know, what do you hope to see in Alaska? What's top of mind for you as a young person? This teen was trans and, sorry, I'm going to try not to cry. And they just kind of looked at me in the way young people do because they say it so simply. They said, why don't people want us to be happy? Like, could you find that out for me? And I can't answer that question for them, but I can try to take a first step in making sure that they feel safe and that they feel welcome. And that military families that don't get a chance to decide where they're stationed, make sure that they can feel safe and welcome. That businesses can operate here with the same non-discrimination ordinances across the board and ensure their employees are taken care of. And to make sure that we stop losing young people in droves, which is what we have done for 10 years. And so this is a first but very important step in making Alaska a place where people feel safe and welcome. And I hope that you can help me send a message to these young people that is what we intend to do. Thank you for your consideration of this bill over the past couple of weeks. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Representative Ruffridge, what is the will of the committee?
No, thank you, Chair Sumner. I would move House Bill 99, also referred to as 33-LS0386/Bravo, with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay, without objection, House Bill 99 has been moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. On record, we stand adjourned at 4:40 p.m. Thank you.